Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the Mentally Chill podcast. I'm your host, Kristen Carney, and I don't know why my voice just went up like that. It was weird. Welcome to the show. I was intimidated taping this week's episode because I have Fred Stoller on, who was a comedian in the 80s and 90s, and he used to write for Seinfeld. He was on Seinfeld. He was recurring on Everybody Loves Raymond. He was that guy in Dumb and Dumber with the trench coat on who was annoyed, and he says to the bad guy in the phone booth, "Get off the phone." I don't know if you guys remember that the way I do, but I was very, very, very excited slash intimidated getting to talk to him. So at the beginning, we talk a lot about stand-up and the scene of show business, but then we really, really, really do get into the meat and potatoes of his depression, or lack of meat and potatoes, because he doesn't have much of an appetite, nor do I lately. And we also talk about how he, quote, throws out his brain, just like you throw out your elbow. He says he threw out his brain with anxiety. But then he also has an epiphany on the show, and it was a great one for me to hear. And it was basically stop trying to do things that don't feel right for you. And that felt very apropos because I decided right before I taped this episode that I was moving, or am moving, from Los Angeles to New York City. And it's been something I've been denying myself of for years and years and years. And I've been trying to be a square peg in a round hole kind of thing. And so what he says hit me pretty hard and has stuck with me, and I'm so glad that he said it. So I hope you like the episode. Of course, thanks to Tracy, my new Patreon child. Thank you for joining, and I hope to see you at the movie night this Saturday, July 21st. I had to change it from 6:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. Pacific time. So 7 p.m. Pacific time. And you know what? The last time was saying I was nervous to show a movie that I really like because I don't want people to dislike it. But I'm trying to get brave, and so I'm going to show the movie that I really want to show, which is Blue Jasmine, starring Cate Blanchett. I never know if I say her name right, Cate Blanchett or Blanchett. I never really know. But she is amazing in it. It's got a little bit of a mental health theme. So if you guys want to join us to watch Blue Jasmine this Saturday, just go to patreon.com/mentallychill, and you can join. And also, if you want to follow me on Twitter or Instagram. On Instagram, I'm at Chris Carn, K-R-I-S-C-A-R-N. And on Twitter, I'm at Kristen Carney, K-R-I-S-T-E-N-C-A-R-N-E-Y. And recently I tweeted something, it was a retweet, of the size of Earth from space. And if you're wanting to put things in perspective, I suggest looking at that. If something's going wrong in your life, if a little thing is bothering you, just remember how minuscule we all are and this all is, and that it's going to be over before we know it. And so don't let the little things drag you down, even though that's kind of what I've made my life around, are the little things. Just realize that, you know, if they're giving you anxiety and making you feel bad, they don't matter. So anyway, oh, and I keep forgetting to say this. I had said between June 1st and July 1st, for anyone who wrote a review on iTunes, I would pick out my favorite review and give you a free month on Patreon. I think subconsciously I haven't brought it up yet because I honestly feel like a jerk not giving everyone a free month on Patreon. But to be honest with you, I think I'd be a little bit overwhelmed. So I do feel really guilty picking one person because you guys wrote such wonderful, lovely, lovely reviews. And I genuinely, this pains me. And I'm almost giving myself too much credit because I'm assuming you really even want the free month on Patreon. Assuming you do, QWERTY1234HVVGUC, I'm assuming that's your middle name. If you'd like a free month on Patreon, I would love to give it to you. So email me at contact@mentallychillpodcast.com. Everyone else, I'm so sorry. I feel like such a dickhead and I'm never doing this again because my conscience is killing me. But anyway, yeah, QWERTY, hit me up and we'll work something out. So anyway, that's it. That's my little spiel for the top of the show, and I hope you guys enjoy the rest of it. Tell me about why you're not doing stand-up. I'm excited to hear you talk about it. I get excited over nothing. Well, first, but I'm excited about this.
First, I want to say that it's funny that it's a podcast about depression. Like, I was obvious. Oh, he should be on it. Like, the funny thing is, I didn't really think I was depressed growing up. I guess I'm so old that it wasn't like a term. It was not like every podcast and thing where you, oh, well, I could relate to that. I thought I had anxiety. I thought depression was, you know, poets that write sad songs or, you know, that memorize poems and, you know, or people put away. But when I started doing stand-up, wow, so old, in 1978. Wow. And I thought I just had severe arrested development adolescence because I was still a virgin. I didn't know how to talk to women or anyone. And I remember I would talk at the comedy club. There'd be a pause and they'd go, do you see a therapist? I didn't realize how off the charts I was. So basically what happened was, I'm going to take a sip of water.
Okay. I'll improv here. That was my improv.
Right. That when I started doing stand-up, it wasn't like now where young people are comedy nerds and they study it and they've watched it. I only got into it because, excuse me, I knew the real world wasn't for me. Talk about depression. I was like paralyzed with anxiety. What am I going to do? I knew I wouldn't be an architect or a dentist or guy that fixes doors. I just had no skills and thought there was something wrong with me. And I remember going to camp, and one guy in camp, his father owned a dice company. I'm going to inherit this. I'm going to inherit that. What am I going to inherit?
A dice company.
His father made dice.
Oh, that's so random.
It's very random. Yeah. But he goes, I'm going to run the dice company, which he never did. But he kind of felt he had something.
Well, he rolled the dice on it. Yeah, I had to say that. It's terrible.
I didn't think of that. But but I remember going, what the fuck am I going to do? I thought that was, well, you can't sit politically incorrect, but I thought I was retarded. My mother made me feel something was wrong with me. So I remember going, what am I going to do when I get older? Everyone's going, it's dodgeball, enjoy yourself. I was paralyzed with depression. Okay, so long story. When I'd see character actors on TV, weirdos with three-line parts, I go, I'm like them. I could be like them.
My people.
Yeah, so I didn't know how you pursued that. It's not like now where everything's savvy. You have, you know, behind the scenes on DVDs or, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was more organic.
Right. I know how you did that. I thought your parents had to put you in the Brady Bunch. You had to start as a child. But then I went with my older sister to a comedy club in Brooklyn. And it was actually Richard Lewis and Billy Crystal before they made it big.
Wow.
And one of my sister's friends explained that I didn't know what stand-up comedy was. You know, again, they didn't have YouTube. They didn't have they didn't even have cable.
They also didn't have lots and lots of depression.
Yes, yes. So I didn't know anything, yeah. But you got to be exposed to something. So someone told me, Jimmy Walker, Freddie Prinze, what stand-up comedy is you do your act at the Improv, a comedy club, and then they get on The Tonight Show, and then they get put in a sitcom. So I said, that's how I could be on Happy Days or a show. So I saw a path. And I was, as I said, not only depressed, chronically depressed and shy. So I thought, all I have to do is do it twice. Once at the Improv, then I'll go on The Tonight Show, and I'll I'll be a character actor. So I tried it at 17, then quit for 3 years. And
oh, you were really young, 17.
Yes,
wow.
Yes, it was ridiculous. I was like, couldn't look at the audience. I only did it a few Sundays. It was too traumatizing. So then in the 80s, I got caught up in the comedy boom in New York, where there was, you know, New Jersey, Long Island, Connecticut. You could make discos, bars, a marginal living. And I got like a kind of unique style only because I couldn't look at the audience. I was so shy and talked about how my mother said there was something wrong with me and did morbid one-liners. So that led to, you know, just all the cable shows every comedian was on in the 90s. And it never felt right. And I thought I was lazy. Am I a sore loser? Why did I love getting the light? I couldn't wait to get off. I loved when I'd headline, they'd switch to middle with me and I have to do less time. But I was sort of getting known from cable. I did a young comedian special. And everyone goes, it's the ultimate. And it never Yes, I think because I had such severe depression, I grew up not trusting my feelings to the extent, and as I'm older, I got more confident. I needed everything validated. Was this guy an asshole? Was this guy a bully? I would tape phone calls with people to get validation. My mother was ridiculous or some woman was ridiculous. I get to the point where I, because my mother didn't validate my feelings, like, oh, he was a bully. Maybe it's you, or I'm sick, I don't feel well. It's in your head, you're a hypochondriac. Mm-hmm. So I would, I never trusted any feelings. Do I have a right to not enjoy stand-up? Do I have a right to think this, to not go on a date? Or I didn't even know the term social anxiety. I wish I knew it, because I would force myself in showbiz to go to parties or barbecues, thinking you got to try, and it took me a long while. The social anxiety, just it doesn't suit me. So that's my long story about stand-up, where I'd come into comedy clubs, you know, and there's, I don't have to tell you, aggressive ones, a testosterone, the hipster, the too cool. Mm-hmm. Paul Preventa had a show, The Green Room, where comics sit around and shoot the shit. I never want to sit with comedians and hear them talking. So I'd always, any party, any comedy club, I would go in the corner and stare at the TV in the corner, no matter what it was. And I do that with parties, like gravitate to the animal, look at the bookshelves. So I can't watch shows like Pete Holmes' show or...
Oh, my God. Okay, I need
because
to
Because I don't want to... It's disgusting. I don't hang out at clubs, so why do I want to watch a show with you? Hey, dude.
Okay, well, I need to...
Shut up. I talked too long.
No, the only reason I need to stop you is because I'm almost... I get excited over nothing. Yeah. I relate with people very rarely.
Yeah.
And everything that you're saying resonates with me. 500%, and I almost don't know where to start right now. There's so many.
See, that's
presents.
Why I talk so much. I just go on a rant, and I'll shut up.
No, but it was perfect, and I want you to keep talking as much as possible.
Oh, yeah, interrupt, interject, whatever. Yeah.
Well, I relate with you so much with all of that, with the needing permission to not like stand up.
Needing permission and feelings.
Yeah,
like if someone's an asshole or something doesn't seem right.
Always. Every decision
validation,
I make.
Validation, yes. That's why in Facebook, you like when someone validates. Yes, permission, validation.
Well, a lot of the time when I tweet something, I'll text it to a friend and I'll say, is this funny? In my gut, I kind of think, okay, this is funny. This is, I think I have a decent sense, but I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
It's not with me just even funny. It's like on Facebook, even if it's not a joke, I want people to validate a feeling, even if it's not a joke, like this person's, decision. This is annoying.
But decisions, do you have a hard time?
One of my biggest regrets, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No,
this.
You're good.
As a writer for many years, I would try out my ideas on everyone. I never have the confidence to express myself, to write. I go, is this good? Oh, that's been done. Or why do you always write about yourself? And late in life, I just write now these memoirs and these books. And I go, this is what I'd like to read. This is valid because it's my feeling, but I would try out as a young comic jokes on everyone at the bar. I never had the balls to go. This is like a friend of mine. I won't mention her name. Nice comic, but she's my age and she's just as needy for validation. Like she does these storytelling things, and she'll have some guy help punch it up or it's a story, your story, there's a comedian, Glenn Hirsch in my comedy days did a joke that the summer essay was write back to school, what happened over summer vacation, and the teacher marked him wrong, which is funny because but it's what it's like, this is our experience, and people right. go, no, it's wrong, so yeah.
Right. Oh God, I was going to refer
I'm gonna
back
stop
to-
talking
because
no,
I'm no,
interrupting
no, no.
too
I'm-
much.
Honestly, I'm frustrated because I'm buckling because I'm relating to every single thing that you're saying, and I want to be able to express that to you.
Yeah.
But the decision thing I've struggled with forever. But
you try it. You run it by a lot of people.
Well, it's not that I'm not even outgoing enough to run it by a lot of people. I just doubt everything that I do, every decision I make, everything I do. But what frustrates me about you and about stand-up comedy is that you are the epitome to me of a real comedian. Yet the irony is that you can't really, if you are truly a true comedian, you can't really do it because those qualities make you go away from things like that.
That's a good point. You know, and when I got into stand-up comedy showbiz, it was weird because I'm a misfit in every kind of way. And I thought I'd be with other misfits like me.
That's what I thought.
But they're all regular people.
Right.
They're the cool guys. Well, it's nerds that grew up and now overcompensating and being cool or snarky. It's the bro guy. So it's like it's high school, but it's in show business. Yes, they're regular guys. The guys who sit around a writer's table, they're Harvard, they're regular guys. So showbiz wasn't the land of misfits. I gravitated towards misfits. Comedians I gravitated the most towards were ones like me that didn't want to do it.
That's my problem with stand-up right now. On the last episode that aired, I said, well, I don't do stand-up because I'm so uncomfortable in my skin and I don't like the way I appear on stage. But then after I posted that episode, I kind of thought to myself, am I making excuses and I don't even really like stand-up? Well, I don't like, when I started stand-up, I thought I was going to find my people because I always felt like I didn't belong.
My people are ones that don't do stand-up.
Right. I was so disappointed because I thought when I got involved in stand-up, everyone was going to be you, like you. And no one was. Everyone's confident.
They don't thrive in it. You got to hang out and vie for stage time. And you got, again, I wish I knew I had social anxiety because the clubs, you're hanging out with all these people every night.
Yeah, the socializing, it's exhausting.
Yes, it's too much. So, yeah, it took me so long to trust my feelings. It doesn't feel right.
Did it feel right, the actual moment of being on stage?
Yes and no, because I never saw myself as a guy that's going to do Carnegie Hall and do concerts.
Right.
And I never loved being up there that long. It was, I think I faked it and was able to get by. But I think, I'll give you a few examples. When I had my first book out, and I'd started going on podcast only to promote it. And I enjoy expressing myself this way more than on stage.
Me too. See, I'm overwhelmed with relating to you right now.
Because, I wish you weren't moving. But
I know.
Cool,
we bad timing.
Yeah. Because I think with stand-up, I feel like I'm like doing a trick, like a mule that's a flip or a monkey that can jump in the air.
Does it feel contrived to
you?
Yes, because you've already done the jokes a million times.
Like 2 years ago, Norm Macdonald gave me the opportunity to open for him. And they were great crowds. But still, it's like, da-da-da-da, laugh. Da-da-da-da, laugh. And I go deeper in stand-up, I can't go deep than, let's say, a guy, Marc Maron, who sits on the stool.
Right.
And I still, from the 80s, have the cadence of da-da-da, laugh. And my Seinfeld year, and I did another Kindle single, and I could go a little bit deeper, just more vulnerable without joke, joke, joke. I think I can tell my story. It's like, for example, I hope what I'm talking about is more relatable to people like me or you than my jokes. My jokes, yeah, I feel like I said, I'm a monkey doing a flip. That, you know, and gets like treats. All right, long-winded. When I did stand-up, it never felt right because of that, too, that I think I always say I like to read not to escape but to relate. And I like reading books or movies, seeing them about lonely misfits. And so I think I feel happiest writing that when, like, my books maybe weren't bestsellers, but when it resonates with people, hits a chord, I like that. So I think I didn't know my strength or my real passion was writing these kind of memoirs rather than stand-up where next is so-and-so, hey, I could get them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's why I've gravitated toward podcasting.
Yeah.
It just feels more natural. I don't feel like I have to play the game. Yeah, it's not prepared. You know, I like the natural organicness of a podcast versus the pressure and the contrived feeling doing stand-up.
Yeah, and again, I'll tell you, 99% of comics who have, like Bill Burr and Norm Macdonald, who have great careers and everything, rather do stand-up than anything else.
Right.
I don't relate. They love... I enjoy, like, doing, say, a one-day part on something where something silly, where I'm on a garbage truck, or, I don't know, more fun. You're on a set. Showbiz, even when I worked for Norm Macdonald, it still felt kind of sleazy in that you're in some... walking under the underbelly of a casino, and oh, you could eat food there, and oh, can I take Jell-O? No, you know, come on. I don't know. It just, even the high end stuff feels a little strip clubby.
Yeah.
Meaning, yeah, even if it's a casino, it just, and, but showbiz, a voiceover job or an acting job, like I was so thrilled with, you know, my book, getting a check for writing a book, and it was a small, small check for my book, Maybe We'll Have You Back. But that feels more exciting. Stand-up, it just feels like a sad life, guys hanging out like at a strip club, it feels like.
Right. Well, like, I mean, you know, everyone's that I know, I started 10 years ago, and now everyone I know is, you know, we're well into adulthood, and it's, you're out every Friday night and acting like you're in high school.
Exactly.
Did that depress you when you found out that it really wasn't your thing?
Again, it took me so long to accept that. I struggled. You know, I dated some woman, and on paper it all sounded great, but there was a disconnect. And I didn't want validation, like, didn't trust my feelings about even a girl I dated. Like, you like it when it's bludgeoning, like, oh, she's a psycho, or she like spit out the window and threw things.
Right.
You know, so with stand up, when again, I didn't go into it thinking, I thought I would leave it almost right away, but I got caught in the comedy boom.
Yeah. Well, I used to kind of do a joke that was like, if a relationship is mediocre, you don't really have that moment to break up. I would be like, you know what, just hit me. Just give me an excuse to leave. And I want stand up to do something like that. Just do something so awful to me that I finally have to break.
Well, you know something? I have that with my mother, where I almost envied people that were hit, or, you know, because mixed messages screw up a kid worse.
Right.
Because you if it's so black and white, you go, like, I remember seeing some interview with Macaulay Culkin, who said his father hit him. He goes, that's it, we're done. And the fact that, you know what I mean, I'll talk about trusting feelings. People would meet my mother, she's sweet, boy, she's adorable, what are you talking about? She's just a Jewish mother. No, and I used to do a joke, it's like the show Mr. Ed would only talk for Wilbur. It's like my mother was like Mr. Ed. So I think mixed messages do screw you up when it's off and it's bad. But you want it to be so bad where it's, I think those people are less fucked up. The ones that had real bad, they go, I'm done.
Right, because it's disconnect. Not shadow boxing. You know exactly what you're working with.
You disconnect.
Right.
Yes. And you disassociate rather than thinking, you want the validation. So with stand-up, I never went into it going, oh, I'd love to do this. Just fell into it.
Yeah. When I started, I think that I got my hopes up really high because I thought, this is my thing. These are my people. This is my world. And then I actually saw it and met the people. I fell pretty hard after that. And then I thought, well, what am I going to do? Because I'm like you, I can't fix things. I'm not going to be an engineer. My mom told me I'll never be a rocket scientist or a doctor in the most loving way, of course. But I'm the type, I don't have skills either. I'm not cut out to be in a regular job, but I'm also not cut out to do stand-up. So it's left me in this, and that's been very difficult because I'm already very isolated in my everyday life, let alone now in my career. It's like, well, I don't even fit in here. Jeez,
I don't fit in. Like, I actually tried doing a podcast, and it was very random, and it's, even though I'm babbling now, I'm not the type, like, I know you work with Adam Carolla, where he could talk about anything for an hour every moment.
I've asked him before. I said, do you ever just wake up and you're like, no, I don't want to talk today? And he said, no.
No.
Not once.
Or like a Bill Burr who can do like a rant for an hour.
Right.
I'm not that. And I think I'd be repetitive, annoying. And you know, just every, do we having to do it every week? We're bugging people to be on it and all that. So I don't fit in.
Speaking of bugging people to be on it, I bugged you because people have been pushing me. So this guy who works at a podcast network was like, you look at all these people that follow you on Twitter. You need to tap in and have some of these really funny, good people on your show. I'm like, I don't want to bother these people.
Right.
But that's why I wrote to you, because he sent me a list of people. He's like, I went through who follows you on Twitter.
Oh.
And, you know, you should have this person, this person, this person. I'm like, I don't want to reach out to these people.
Book,
it's embarrassing.
But with a book, you got to get blurbs. You got to please tweet
right,
my link.
Right.
I know, and I've pitched ideas, and I hate when it's contingent on what celebrities you can get. Yeah. So it's a lot of pushing. Yeah.
Yeah. I wish I was more cut out for something like this, just because I don't know what else I'm supposed to do. So I try to ignore my instincts that are don't annoy people, don't reach out, don't hustle, and, you know, don't market yourself. I have to ignore those instincts every single day, because otherwise, what else do I do? I don't, you know, and I've often wished that you just said about, you know, being abused physically, like
it's more black and white.
It's more black and white. And like, I wish that I physically looked like you. Because
why is that? No one ever said
I've
that.
I've always said this because I fit, like, I don't really fit anywhere. Like, you have a look, you're a character. Like,
right.
You can, I'm again with even the way I look physically, I kind of just float in this no man's land.
I mean, for acting.
Yeah. Like, I used to say, God, I just wish that I was like, Steve Buscemi or something, because it's like everyone knows who he is. You look at me, I'm a brunette,
well,
generic white girl, you know.
You,
it,
like, for example,
sucks.
I used to audition, once in a while for commercials.
You've never heard that. No one else has said that in the history of life. It sucks being a brunette white girl.
Yeah.
But it does right now, because, you know, you're supposed to be either diverse or a niche.
I relate to that only in that, like, I would, commercials, I'm not funny looking enough. If they just want a funny looking guy.
But like,
I
know who you are. You're like the Jew guy from New York who's
right.
funny and neurotic.
Right.
That, like, I can place you. And
right.
I always just wish that I could be placed.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard. It's hard. Well, I don't feel I've been placed. Like, the books I've had out, I go on these comedy podcasts, and I don't think those are my people who would read it. Like, you know, Jay Moy, dudes, you
right.
know, or Artie Lang show, you
right.
know. It's just, and I don't fit in because, you know, the people on Twitter make it, I'm not like a comedy guy, like a Blaine Kapach or a, you know what I mean, in that thing. And even with acting and stuff, so I'm still trying to figure it out. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. It's consoling in a way
yeah.
to hear that, but also frustrating just because I think you're so funny and so talented that I don't want you to have to still try to figure it out.
Well, I'll give you an example. Part of me thinks, oh, I don't get auditions. Maybe I should get another agent. But to be honest, any part I get, someone wants me or not. I don't fit into puzzles.
Right.
So I don't want to go in these heat waves to Warner Brothers and wait and sit with 15 other people to do stuff I've done already. I want to just be creative. And so, like I said, I'm writing these kind of stories that I hope becomes my own thing, my niche, rather than fitting into, like I say, other people's puzzles.
Well, once you kind of see Hollywood and show business up close, everything changes. Because last night I bought your book, My Seinfeld Year,
uh-huh.
and I was going through some of the Amazon reviews, and a lot of them, the first thing that popped out from every single review was, in more. He is so funny. Where is he? Why don't they put him in more things?
It's just like, I think I'm grateful for the acting parts, but it's always the three-line weird guy, hey, I got the wrong package, and I got older, and they... I think with sitcoms, I'm too old to be the weird delivery guy or the schmucky guy, the bartender. And I think comedy, they don't have as many sitcoms as they had. And it's not like the snarky kind of The Office. Like, you know, they're more hip and dry. You know
what I mean? I know, yeah.
I'm just like an old kind of old school schmuck.
I just...
You know, it doesn't fit into sitcoms today.
And that bothers me. And you mentioned not watching like the Pete Holmes show. I watched like one episode of that, but the only shows that I watch are Seinfeld, Frasier, and murder shows.
Uh-huh.
Because I so don't feel like I fit into this new world of...
Yes,
yeah,
snarky,
of every,
kind
yeah,
of like The Office or those... They're just very dry, or I'm sure he's a great guy or whatever. I never met Nick Offerman, the kind of just... They're still cool, you know?
Yeah,
they're
it's like there's
too
much
cool.
of a coolness of it. And that's
yes.
that's what disappoints me with comedy today.
That Chris Hardwick show, what was that show? At Midnight, yes.
Yeah, like that stuff. That I never tried.
Kind of snarky, you know, or I hated that show, Best Week Ever, where they're all...
Everyone's too... The problem is with comedy today that truly makes me feel so sad is that everyone's too okay with themselves.
Yeah.
They're all just so self-assured. Look how cool I am. Look how cool my Instagram is. Look how great my jokes are. Look
how
many
Twitter
followers.
That's the thing I always say.
But it's like, why... You're not funny. You're too self-assured. I don't
find
that funny.
I never got into comedy to be cool.
But that's what people are doing
comics,
now.
Yes.
Which is so weird.
Comics weren't cool, like, you know, but yeah. So yeah, a lot of the sensibility I don't fit into.
I don't know, being an old soul or not being part of a scene, it's really hard to connect to things today.
It's very isolating and like last night it was too hot and I just laid on my couch sometimes with depression. I'll go back to your topic. I can't even like watch TV.
I just don't feel
like being engaged.
I just lie
there and but whatever I do makes more sense than going to a comedy club.
Okay.
But when I get depression, I can't. People claim they're depressed, but then they'll binge watch shows. When I'm depressed,
I can't
even look at anything.
No. Okay. So this is the thing that I do mostly is I lay and do nothing, which I always refer back to a line from Seinfeld where Jerry's like, what are you doing to Elaine? And she says nothing. And he's like, well, you got to be doing something. She's like, no, I'm literally doing nothing. I'm sitting and staring. That is what I do when I'm depressed. I literally am sitting and staring or laying and staring.
Whatever's on Netflix, whatever you stream.
I know that I know my depression is bad. And I've actually talked about this on a podcast before. I said, like, I can't. TV used to be the thing, like when I wanted to.
I don't escape.
I can't even escape to TV anymore.
Nope.
I feel almost this weird, numb blanket.
Don't want
come
to engage.
No engagement.
Yes,
zero.
I get like that. Where once in a while, I have to put on a to-do list.
Watch TV.
Watch a show. See, I have this weird thing. And I've told this to someone I know who's gone through a depression worse than me. He goes, he doesn't know where he is in his career, what to do. I go, make a to-do list. Even if it's take the garbage out. Or it's sometimes with a depression, it's monumental to do a chore, to mail a letter.
Yeah, it is.
And I think what, you know, it's like my cat who died, he had this before he died. He was sick and he wasn't eating and he'd eat a treat like a good boy. Then I went through a depression where I couldn't eat. And I remember I treat myself like my cat, just eating a little bite and going, good boy. So I tell myself, good boy, if I take the garbage out, if I do a chore. So sometimes I do this thing where whatever my indulgences are, Fred, once you do this to-do list, then you can have the ice cream or do this or that. So sometimes it's even watch an episode of whatever to just feel I'm making a connection. But yeah, like I have Movie Pass, which, you know, you could see a movie every day for $10 for the month. When I'm, even with a free movie, if someone's not meeting me there, it's so hard to go to the Grove a few blocks away, and sit there. And have you ever had this people go, if you're depressed, go see a movie? No, that's worse.
I want to say I agree. The thing is for me is the movies is the only place where I can go to actually feel okay. So, like, even though it's hard for me, though. Like, the other day I wanted to go. I was so depressed, and I just didn't end up going. I actually bought the ticket and just never went. But on 4th of July, I don't do the kind of 4th of July stuff. So I was alone all day. I was laying in my bed. I was very lonely, very depressed. I had a really long, bad day. I went to a movie at the end of the day just to try to snap myself out of it.
Yeah.
But it was, like, the action of going was like, I had 5,000 bricks on each feet, like, just go, just do this. I ended up going to like an 11 o'clock because I couldn't make it to the 7.
Yeah,
I couldn't make it to the 9. I just finally was like, just Kristen, just go, just do this. You know, your brain needs it. And then once I get there, I start to wake up a little bit.
Yes.
But that it's the giving your sick cat the treat and they're just, it's just kind
just
of
baby steps.
It's baby steps. And that is me all the time.
Yes.
When I'm feeling depressed. So you got in a depression after your cat passed away.
Well, this is what happened. I think, like I said, I didn't think I had depression. I thought I oversensitive, had anxiety. And what happened was no one was helping me. I think I put myself in some crazy place in my head where I thought I was going to lose my apartment or someone was going to move in and blast an electric guitar. I don't know what I did, but I displaced myself Like, where would I live?
Even though there was nothing happening to actually make that.
I was anticipating stuff, and it caused, the anxiety caused something to short circuit in my head where I had a depression I never saw the likes of. I think I had so much anxiety of anticipating. I think there used to be a guy that lived in the other apartment, and I shared the wall, and he'd play the electric guitar, but I would tell him, don't do it. And then, but I was cool with him. I go, Jim, could you not? And I thought someone was going to move in next to me, was going to be an asshole, not listen, play an electric guitar. In my head, I put myself, but then where would I move? And I felt closing in my own apartment.
Yeah.
Where would I move? I got to get out. I love it here. And it caused something to short circuit in my head where I saw why people end their lives. I was walking around crying. I couldn't eat.
Oh, my God.
And I think I saw that no talk therapy would do it. I had to get on antidepressants, and every night I take the pill and go, I hope the medicine works. And once it kicked in, I saw how I've been depressed my whole life, but didn't realize it. Again, the anxiety caused my brain to short circuit where, like, for example, I would put myself in situations like, think about taking my cat to the vet the last time to put him down, or being 80 in a heat wave walking down Fairfax Avenue deciding where to eat. You know, I would futurize, and I think I'd always walk around depressed, but it didn't explode. So now I realize when I have a depression that I threw my brain out. It's like throwing your elbow out. You can't just say snap out of it. When I kind of short circuit, but now thanks to antidepressants, it's not what it was. But now I know I threw out my brain.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was, oh, it was like, wow, what happened? I think, like I said, I could maintain my anxiety, but the depression flooded something where I just, it was like, so I would lie there. You know, they talk about, you know, AA and rock bottom. My rock bottom was...
This podcast.
was I'd wake up in the morning screaming, help me.
Oh, my God.
Where it's like, I think the respite of sleep, when I'd wake up, I'd scream, help me. It was so bad. And where... Have you had depressions where you couldn't eat?
Yes. And I'm actually kind of in one right now.
All right.
And just in time for summer, though, which is great timing.
Oh, I learned... I went to Air One. I have anxiety when... I have a lot of anxiety related to eating, only in the fact that I need to go out. I don't cook. I'm a schmuck, but I need to get out of my place. But I hate eating alone. I feel so self-conscious. I have anxiety where I want to bolt. I like where there's no waitress service. I don't want to wait for the check. I need to bolt wherever I am. And I just had, sometimes I don't feel like putting food in me, so I learned those shakes are good. Like at Air One, I had a smoothie because just the eating and the cutting and then everything. So what the hell was the...
Well, I always say dishes are enough to make me lose my appetite. I'm like, oh, I got to cook. That means dishes. I just feel sick to my stomach now.
Yeah, I like to just go to a place and no waitress service, a piece of pizza, and then you don't wait for your check. You know, but
that's why as a teen, I felt that need to bolt too. And I would always drive everywhere. When I was 16 and older, I started because then I was in control of when I could leave.
It took me a while to learn that. Well, that's what's good about Uber now. Like at parties,
you can leave. You don't have to wait for your friend.
Yeah. And that, with social anxiety, I learned to leave a party. If you say, I'm leaving, what are you talking about? Mechami hasn't come here yet. They think you're rude, but if you leave, they don't notice. But yes, again, trusting your feelings, learning it doesn't feel right, leave, as opposed to forcing it. But what did I interrupt about myself about the eating or the... this is what I had, but I couldn't eat, and I knew I had to. And I still have this sometimes where I would go back to sleep and dream I just ate something. I go, oh, that's good. Then I go, oh, no, I didn't. I do have to. It took a Herculean effort to get out, go get food. I go through that once in a while still where I have anxiety, and it helps sitting with a laptop and putting words down because I feel each meal isn't lonely because I'm being productive and putting more words down in what I'm writing. But sometimes I can't deal with trying to figure out where to go to eat. And look, everyone, I'd hate me because people can't afford to eat. So I'm not complaining. I'm lucky I have the money to eat. I'm not complaining. I'm just saying that sometimes, yes, when I went through that depression, it was a Herculean effort just to go out and put food in me, yeah.
Same, always. I go through phases where my fridge will have stuff in it because I must have popped out of my depression. I went to the grocery store. I did the normal people thing. But then once I get it, I never cook it. It just sits there. But then eventually it either goes bad or I eat through it a little bit. And then I have nothing for 2 months in my fridge. And it's because I don't have the mental energy to figure out what to get, where to go to get it, to fight traffic to get it.
Exactly.
And I'm like, I'd rather not eat.
Oh, God, I have to buy a new car. And I can't deal with go online, do this one, do that one. I wanted to go on Adam's podcast because he would give me advice, but I couldn't get through. Oh, that's right. Of course, you know Dr. Drew through him. And it's too much. It's just someone tell me what car to buy.
In the same way.
Yes. I can't look online. That's why.
Well, when Dr. Drew did my podcast a couple weeks ago, he said the name, and I need to go back and listen. I can't listen to myself speak, so the act of going to re-listen is just like the act of going to buy food. It's just too hard. But he said the name of something, there's a name for the problem people have to take the first step in something. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember what the name of it is, but for me, it's the first step. Like, how do I, if I go get a new car, what do I do first? Do I start, what's the first step? And then because the first step overwhelms me so much, I just don't do it at all.
It's just people go online, check out price this, that, you get a three-year-old with a warranty of this. It's like, I almost just want to pay more and get it over
right.
with.
I always kind of think in my head, well, the reason I don't have money is because God knows how badly I'd spend it. Because I would just pay people to do things for me all the time because I hate doing anything. So if I had to buy a new car, I'd just be like, here's some money, you go figure it out. You know, and I have to move back to New York. And I basically have procrastinated for 10 years because I don't know how to physically go 3,000 miles. It's like, how do I figure out how to get my stuff? And then it's going to cost money. And then I have to have people. Do I drive? Do I fly? I've got a dog. He can't go on the plane because he's going to rip people's faces off. And I just, so it's a whole process. And because of that, I shy away from living and finally making the decision to just go to New York yesterday. I didn't call. I emailed some moving places. But that step for me, I mean, it's been 10 years in the making to type out, hi, I'm moving to New York. Can you tell me pricing for sending back this item and this item and this item? And of course, no one's gotten back to me. And now I have to actually make phone calls. But that is so exhausting. It's such a...
Me too. I think that's my anxiety. I get overwhelmed in processing. Mm-hmm. And yes.
So being on antidepressants, though, it's better than it would be naturally for you. But it's still hard.
It's good because now I'm aware, like I say, that when I have stuff, I threw my brain out. But, you know, I was just going to say, even though I'm using the word social anxiety, that's such a... I don't agree with that word because it means parties, barbecues doesn't suit me. It's like if a disorder is bulimia or cutting yourself, that's very destructive. So I think it's about trusting my feelings and self-acceptance where if I rather pay a little bit more and buy a car with someone's advice than spend weeks on the internet.
Which doesn't feel right.
Well, yeah. Why is that a defect? And same with you.
Right.
It's like it feels like people would always say, Fred, why do you live in an apartment? You should have a condo or a house or, well, I don't know why they think I have more money than I do, whatever. But it's like I rather have not good AC and have extra money to walk around and not freak out if I eat out every meal than freak out about a mortgage and the insurance and this and, the rental fee. You know what I'm saying?
I don't know how we all survive. There's so much. Like, it's all so exhausting.
So why is it a defect? You, Kristen, me, Fred, this feels right. Some people will say it's a defect that I get overwhelmed. But yeah, maybe I'd rather lie on the couch or try to be creative or do what I want to do than what Well, yeah, we could argue why is it a defect.
I love that you're making that point. I think maybe people say it's a defect because naturally we're supposed to be social creatures, and that's going against the nature. So maybe that's why it's a defect. But when I was younger, I thought, okay, well, I guess people love the outdoors, so maybe I should be outdoorsy.
Yeah.
But I wasn't outdoorsy. I like concrete for some reason. I like to feel like I'm in a sprawling urban area. And so I went through a phase where I was like, maybe I'm a hippie and I like nature. And then I'm like, but no, I don't have to do that.
This is interesting because we're figuring out depression or whatever, but maybe it's about acceptance of what suits you.
Right.
And so you could argue, like I've had it when the weather's, you know, not so hot. When you nap a lot, is that depression or I fucking like napping better than most things?
Oh God, I struggle with that all the time because I nap like 5 times a day.
It feels so good. Why is that depression? Maybe if you have a kid that's in the room, you know, you're not paying attention to. But some people go surfing or they jump out of windows for fun or whatever.
My thing is napping.
If napping is so orgasmic or whatever, it feels so good. Yes. Napping is bad if you're doing that 24 hours a day and you're not eating like I had. But it's interesting.
Why is that negative?
Yeah, well, if it suits us, I think, yeah, my thing my whole life is self-acceptance and my mother accepting me. So if I...
Where are you with that?
What do you mean?
The self-acceptance with your mother. What's the relationship like?
Well, I just visited her for her 90th birthday and... It was stressful because I had a cold, and every time I would cough, she'd put a hand in her ears and freak out. Because
I can see it so perfectly.
Because then she told me that...
Is she in Florida?
Yeah.
Oh, I love it.
Her friend's son died of cancer, and it started with a cough, so she was convinced I was dying of cancer.
Right.
So she's not nurturing. So she keeps saying, do you miss never being married? I said, how could I miss what I never had? She goes, I mean, do you feel it's wrong? So she's keeps saying... Inadvertently, there's something wrong with you. You've never been married. You're different, and I am different. So,
do you have siblings?
An older sister, yeah.
Is she married?
Yeah, more than normal stuff. Had a kid, you know, all that stuff. So, I think growing up with a mother, what's wrong? What do you do during the day? Why have you never been married? Why do you have a cat, not a girlfriend? She'd always ask that.
Cats don't ask questions.
Yeah. So, I think I grew up. You know, so basically, I'm there, but I'm not there. I'm just shut down. We don't fight, but we're on eggshells because, you know, she's just panicked and she's always asking, it's just something, you know, it's...
I can see it so perfectly in a sitcom or a movie or something of you and your mother, and your mother's in Florida and the Jewish mother, and it's so perfect and... Part of the reason why I love, I hate to refer back to Seinfeld, but it's like that, you know, they captured that dynamic so well with the Florida retirees you know, the whole thing and the pen, you know, everything, the air conditioning. They capture that so well. And that's what I think is lacking so much in TV today. They don't capture the
humanity
of just that the nagging of life and people.
Everyone
and traditions.
Everyone is so good looking on How I Met Your Mother or Friends.
I know.
They're like, I don't get it. I don't relate to it.
I try to picture, like, if they cast Seinfeld with George was a handsome guy and Kramer was a Joe Rogan type, and it would suck. It would be so unfunny. It's because they were real people, and I just think there's so many real people missing from pop culture today.
Well, I accept I may be missing from showbiz, but I've done well enough where, I can nap when I want, and... I mean, it's a blessing never to have to set my alarm clock most days.
But do you think that would help your mental state? Because I think for me, I live like you. I nap whenever I want. I don't set my alarm clock. And I think the lack of structure really is bad for my brain, but it's what feels natural to me to do. So
I think try to make your own structure where, like I said, my to-do list.
You're right.
And, but I don't want to sound like I'm complaining. I accept. You know,
well, actually, I wanted to talk about that because when you wrote to me, you said, I asked what you might want to talk about. You said depression, but people think you're whining.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many people. Like, I'll give you an example. Dom Herrera, he's the biggest hypochondriac. He's so neurotic, but I could say the same thing he would. Oh, Fred, you're whining. You're just a nebbish. Like Artie Lang. obviously he's neurotic. He's, you know, always doing drugs, but he's a man's man. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he's a guy from New Jersey. He's like gonna bust your balls.
But he's so messed up that, you know, he needs to do all the, can't be in any reality. So just, I guess the way I phrase things, people will say, you're always depressed. Where I didn't think I was that much. I was just, I think I never learned overcompensation. I always give like Greg Fitzsimmons as an example. You know who he is?
Yeah.
He's a scrappy guy. You know, like they, I never learned how to overcome. He's little, so he acts scrappy. Hey, fuck you. I never learned how to do that. I always think deep down I'm more confident because I'm not imitating other confident people. You know, I'm not, you know, but yeah, about, but yeah, it's just like when, it sounds funny, like one of the things that keeps me from committing suicide, it's like, oh, we all saw that coming. Who cares? He's a whiner. He's depressed.
Right. But you don't want to be cliche or fulfill their.
But if Springsteen talks about depression, the boss, how can I help you? Right. It's so cool. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You read Bruce Springsteen's memoir?
No.
Oh, you got it's a lot about depression. But yeah, if Springsteen has depression and he's had it bad, or Artie Lang, hey man, whatever we can do for you. But
yeah,
Fred, shut up, Fred.
Shut up, you're annoying. Yeah, I guess it's the confidence factor that makes them appear as if it's not whining, it's more
bravado. Or
yeah, and then when, you know, someone like you or I feel like we're a little bit less on the confidence, a little bit more neurotic, we come across a little whiny.
Yeah, but you know, I'm getting to the point
where, not that I'm saying you're whiny.
But no, I guess I am, but I'm tired of trying to figure out how to be confident or to pretend I'm confident. I'm just tired of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to learn before, you know, too many more years pass to just be okay with everything I'm doing and who
exactly. I am. Exactly. That again, if I had to be cliche, the self-acceptance is the thing I've struggled with because the way I was brought up and putting, oh, with women, God, all I would do is think they don't want me. They want the brooding animator guy, the cool tech guy, the gaffer. I'd always think what they want and not me. I always think I'm not enough. That I think it was a lot that thinking, like I had a good job for a while, a voiceover, a regular on some show. Yeah, but when that goes off, what woman will want me? Because I felt I'm the guy. This is my job. So the lack of self-acceptance of the freelance, so I am.
So have you got it there at all, though? Like, have you, well, I jokingly always say on the show, I always make people feel worse by the time the show is over. that's the whole theme of the show is make a person sad. And I finally succeed at something. It can make people sad.
I think we're all fucked up, so that's a thing.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, I think the real world, I don't know you well enough to talk for you, but probably never felt right.
No.
And I think other people trick themselves, you know, that it's all made up, 4th of July. It's nonsense. I went to my no more 4th of July barbecues. It's so stupid.
Right. And it's the same holiday over and over. 4th of July,
St.
Patrick's Day, Cinco de Mayo, whatever.
It's all
the same every time.
It's like we're all playing like Pokemon outside when they were. We're playing some stupid.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah. But it's like all life is like we're playing some, you know, fantasy football thing. Like, got to get this. Then you got to do this holiday.
Yeah, it's just to keep our minds busy.
Exactly.
And some people are aware of it and some people aren't.
I think maybe me and you were too
aware.
Self-aware, which should be a good thing.
I know. Well, I was going to say this earlier when you mentioned Bill Burr and those guys who, just talk. And it's interesting because they're so aware of the world and they can make these really great observations, but they don't seem self-aware enough to think, maybe people don't want to keep listening to me. Maybe my voice is getting annoying. You know, they're not thinking those things. So how did they get one aspect of awareness?
I know the way Bill
Burr
can like rip apart the Grammys for an hour and then this and that. And he's a great guy. I mean, I was intimidated when I met him. Such a good guy. But yeah, or Adam could just rip apart like some thing like those scooters.
Oh, I just tweeted about them.
Yes.
I said, kill two people on birds with one stone.
That's a great line. But yeah, the way people will talk an hour about the scooters, I'll talk an hour about neuroses. Yes. Yeah, so I guess
Yeah. I don't know. It's just, I'm jealous of their brains because they're still able to be aware to make those comments and make jokes, but not aware enough to stay home in their bedroom and go, no one wants to hear me.
Right.
That's like a nice little thing to be missing in your brain.
Well, they're not in tune with their neuroses about where they fit into it.
No,
you
not
know,
at all.
So that's who they are. Yeah.
Well, I'm a little jealous of them, but they're going to be jealous of you right now because you get to do cool segments that I do on the show.
Oh, good, good, good.
That I didn't. Usually I explain them before we start taping, but I forgot. So today, this is the first time I've ever done this one. We're going to have a sad off. It's like a dance off, but like a sad off. So who's sadder between you and I?
Okay.
And so we have to kind of compete with either like... You're
compete about
me.
What?
You're looking at me so confused.
Oh, what I think you, why you've had it better?
No, yeah. Like, well, something that makes you sad, and then I come back with something that makes me sad. My friend John from the Wondery Network, the podcast guy I was talking about earlier, he suggested this as a segment. So so you'll say, like, oh, my mom never accepted me. And then I say, oh, well, da-da-da-da. And then you give another one, and then I give another one. We'll see who's our worst.
Why don't you go first?
Okay, everyone who listens to the show has already heard me complain about this before, but I was basically born with a crossed eye, but I got it fixed. But I had.
So that's a sad thing?
Yeah, I was a kid with the lazy eye.
To how long?
I still have it. So when I take off my glasses or take out my contacts, my eye crosses. But I got it. I got a surgery when I was 3 years old. It pulled the muscle straight, but only when I wear contacts or glasses.
I see.
So my whole life, basically, like if I went swimming or something, you know, I was 11, didn't have contacts. My eye would cross and I'd have to kind of cover my eye. So basically
God,
my whole
Bill
life.
Bill Burr's going to be jealous. He doesn't do this.
Told you.
Yeah. All right. So that's your thing, the cross eye?
Yeah.
Well, when my mother was 5 months pregnant with me, she didn't know. She thought she had the flu because she didn't have her period. And the doctor said, no, you're pregnant. So she wasn't even aware she was pregnant with me.
And she was like, damn, I wish it was the flu.
Yes. She kind of didn't want me.
Right.
Well, she was very dependent on her mother. And her mother died of breast cancer. And she told me, when I was a kid, I asked, why did Cindy, my older sister, have a middle name and I don't? And she said, well, you know, but you... were conceived a few months after my mother died, and I felt guilty for having sexual relations after my mother died, and you reminded me of that.
Oh, my God.
So that's why I don't have a middle name, and I cried.
You won the sad off.
All right.
Yeah, you win.
I don't have a middle name because I reminded her that she had sexual relations after her mother died.
Wow. That's really good.
Yeah.
All right, well, you won the sad off. Okay, the next one is antidepressant of the week. So something that you did this week that actually made you feel kind of good or not terrible.
That I did that made me feel good.
Like a good moment, a good thing, a good...
Something that... I've done things that make me feel good. I think I gave something to someone. Something charitable.
It's funny because it's actually so hard to answer this question because, you know, everything feels so mundane all the time that if you ask someone what was good that happened to you this week, generally people can't really answer that.
Yeah.
And even me, like I have time to prepare and think about it, and I still have to really like, what
was
am I
going
to say? Well, mine is going to be getting to have you on my podcast. Aww. And I've never said that before.
Well, this, all right, I'll
it's
do
not
this.
Like I do this for my...
You know, this is good because I was kind of, I'm kind of podcasted out and go, oh God, and well... This is going to sound funny because you're not going to believe it, but it was an excuse to clean my apartment.
Oh, well, there you go.
You're coming here. Even though you're going to go, this is clean. Well, you should have seen it earlier. You should have seen it earlier.
Yeah. I know why your mom didn't give you a middle name now.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I was talking about on the show that came out this week that the person I had on, we were talking about not really appreciating where you are in the moment. And like when you were 12, you know, if you could look where you are now and go, oh my God, so cool. And so I was saying that I have a hard time doing that. But for me, this is kind of one of those moments where I'm trying to be aware of how wonderful this is because when I was watching Dumb and Dumber, uh-huh. I had no idea that one day I'd get That's to chat funny. With the guy at the phone booth who was wow. so fucking funny.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And I also, you know, like when I was about 13 or 14, I started watching Seinfeld. I never felt like I could relate with anyone or anyone got me. And then when I was 14 or so, I started watching Seinfeld. And I went, oh, my God. These people, I get it. Mm. Like, they get me. And so it's cool to be talking to someone who's written Aww. For Seinfeld and been on the show. And
that's so nice.
Yeah. So I'm trying to kind of keep that in perspective to go, you know, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So. I mean, yeah. I just, things like some people I've crossed paths with. Same thing with me working with the late Jack Riley from the Bob Newhart show. The late Charles Durning from Dog Day Afternoon, one of my favorite movies.
That's my dad's favorite movie.
Oh, yeah. So Peter Boyle from...
That's Al Pacino, right?
That was an Al Pacino movie, yeah. So yeah, just those moments too are really very special.
I'm actually glad that I added the segment in because I'm really cynical. I always see the negative of everything and I never look at anything in a positive way. And so adding in this segment... I was trying to add a little positivity because generally it's just I hammer down just the constant.
No, and again,
everything's terrible. So this is a nice way to appreciate.
It's not all terrible. It's just. I think it helps when you have acceptance that you, I think a lot of my beating myself up is what you're supposed to do. What holiday you're supposed to like? You're supposed to love stand up. You're supposed to love parties. You're supposed to do this.
Right.
And I think just embrace. Your whatever misfit in this.
Me moving back to New York is me embracing myself in the way that you're saying, because I've been going, well, you know, what does it say about me? Is this the wrong decision? Because, you know, if someone is really, really pursuing something, they'd stay in LA and keep trying. And I've wiped away all of those standards that aren't really my own and gone. A couple people said, well, isn't that going backwards? And it's like, no, emotionally, no, it's going forward because I love New York and I love the people there. And I'm not...
Feels right.
It feels right. And I'm done. I've been here for 10 years. It has felt wrong every single day. And so finally, I'm just doing something that feels right. I'm scared. I'm super scared. But I'm doing it because I'm trying to be more of what you're saying, which is just accepting.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. And so the last segment we'll do is called F Dat Shit, which is just a little like news article or something about mental health. And because you mentioned about whining, I had seen the other day someone shared an article and it said how complaining rewires your brain for negativity. And it was so funny because I saw it and I was scrolling and I just went, fuck that. And I like kept going. I'm like, I don't want to read about that shit. Like, I complain. Get over it. I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
So today I thought, well, maybe I should check that out because you had mentioned about whining. So anyway, I'm going to read a little of this article. Repeated complaining rewires your brain to make future complaining more likely. Over time, you find it easier to be negative than to be positive, regardless of what's happening around you. Complaining becomes your default behavior, which changes how people perceive you. And here's the kicker. Complaining damages other areas of your brain as well. Researchers from Stanford... I'm like doing a jerk off motion right there for that. has shown that complaining shrinks the hippocampus in your brain, the area that's critical for problem solving and intelligent thought. The hippocampus is scary, especially when you consider that it's one of the primary brain areas destroyed by Alzheimer's. Complaining is also bad for your health because you release a stress hormone called cortisol. Cortisol shifts you into fight or flight mode. So, one effect of cortisol is to raise your blood pressure and blood sugar, so you'll be prepared to either escape or defend yourself. So that makes you more susceptible to high cholesterol, diabetes, heart disease, and obesity. And it makes your brain more vulnerable to strokes. So the good news is I'm dying sooner, which I'm totally fine with.
Yeah.
But I studied abroad in college, and this was one of those things that I tried to do to go, well, maybe I'm supposed to travel and I'm supposed to, you know, go and do nature things. So I studied abroad. I went to Australia and I made one friend. His name was Nick from Canada. And he pointed out, and this is the first time anyone had ever said this to me. I was like 20 or 21. And he's like, you complain a lot. And I went, oh my God, I do. Oh, I'm the worst. And then it took me many years until I started doing stand-up to go, no, this is okay. I'm glad that I complain. This is who I am. This defines me. This is how I make jokes. This is how I be human.
Right.
And so for a while, I was ashamed that I complained, but now I'm accepting that I'm a complainer.
Yeah, acceptance. I don't know if right now we're complaining.
And it's not complaining. It's more like, I think, like, going over details of minutiae.
Exactly. Or more just validating, we don't feel like aliens.
Right.
Because we, you know, I tend to feel like an alien in almost every situation.
Same.
And it's good when you go, wait a minute, why is that stuff right? Why are you supposed to do this or that or feel this? So I think, yeah. So I don't know if it's complaining so much. I think that's what I'm saying. You know,
I think your New York accent doesn't help.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I'm so jealous of your New York accent. Did you grow up in Brooklyn?
Yeah, Brooklyn. Sheepshead Bay.
I can't wait.
Where are you going to move to?
Probably Manhattan, but I don't have a place yet or anything. I'm starting to look, but that's one of those car buying things, you know?
Yeah,
like, oh, I don't know where do I start. I got to do this.
Yep.
So I'll probably be in a box for the first 3 months and then work my way up to...
Work your way up to a... I can't
maybe
think of
a studio. Yeah, I couldn't either. Yeah,
a
maybe.
Box up to a...
That's a big jump from a box
crate.
To a studio. Right. There's got to be an in-between.
Yes.
Yeah, a box to a crate. Anyway. Well, this has been very fun.
Thank you.
Thank
it was
you
a lot of fun.
For coming and letting me talk.
Real people. Well, you don't see it like you are.
I know. That's why I'm getting out of LA. Sorry, there's going to be less and less of us.
Yeah.
But do you want to say where anyone can find you on Twitter or anything like that?
You know, Fred_Stoller on Twitter. And do you edit this?
I do edit this, yeah.
Okay, I trust you. Because I wouldn't want to hear me talk as long as I just talked.
Well, no, I'll edit most of me. Oh. You're staying. Sorry for the bad news.
Whatever you got to do.
I edit, and I edit neurotically, so it will be very clean, very wonderful episode. So thanks again for coming.
Thank you.
Follow Fred on Twitter, and if you guys want to support the show, please do give it 5 stars on iTunes, and do all the things that I was just saying earlier I'm uncomfortable having you do, like I'm asking marketing myself, you know.
Share the show
with a friend, all that shit that I don't really want to say. And that's all. So remember, stay sad enough to listen, but not too sad.
Right. Good point.
Bye, guys.